Thank you and good morning. Welcome. My name is Julie McCarty and I'm a knowledge management specialist for the USAID Bureau for Food Security. And I'd like to welcome you to today's seminar titled From Smallholders to Shareholders, Optimizing Private Sector Engagement for Smallholder Impact. And I'm excited because today this is a jointly sponsored event. It's both a member of the Ag Sector Council seminar series, which is led by the USAID Bureau for Food Security and AgriLinks, and also a member of the MPEP seminar series, which is led by the USAID Office of Microenterprise and Private Enterprise Promotion and MicroLinks. So we're happy to have a jointly sponsored webinar today. And before we get rolling, I always have a couple of housekeeping issues. First and foremost, which is to please silence your cell phones just so that we don't interrupt the speakers. And I always make sure to do that myself as well. But if you are a Twitter aficionado, please feel free to keep your cell phones handy and tweet along with the hashtag AgEvents. And especially if you're joining us online, be sure to check out the Twitter stream. This seminar is being recorded today, and we have a lot of participants joining by webinar. And for that reason, we generally ask that you hold your questions until the speakers have completed their presentations so that we can pass around the microphone and so that the webinar audience can hear your questions. And I just quickly wanted to point out two upcoming events that are hosted by or sponsored by AgriLinks. Next week here in Ronald Reagan Building, we have an event titled Climate Change Impacts on Agriculture and Food Security, Implications for Developing Climate Resilient Agriculture Programs, which is a wrap-up event for the USAID African and Latin American Resilience to Climate Change Program. Quite a mouthful, but it's here in Ronald Reagan Building next Thursday, and you can register via AgriLinks. And we also have an Ag Exchange coming up in November. We'll post more information about that, and if you are a member of the AgriLinks listserv, you'll always get our information about upcoming events. All right, very quickly, I'd like to pass the mic over to my colleague for a few words.
Hi, I'm Kristen Oplanik from the Office of Microenterprise and Private Enterprise Promotion. I'm very excited to be doing this joint seminar today that's bringing together the AgriLinks and MicroLinks communities purposefully for the first time. While these sister communities definitely have some overlap, I'm sure some of you are members of both. If you are only a participant of one and you're interested in topics like today, I encourage you to look at the other. AgriLinks covers all things ag sector development, as you might guess. And MicroLinks covers inclusive market systems and finance topics. So for our next seminar series, next month, November 20th, we will be having a webinar on youth savings and the business and social cases behind pushing that momentum forward. So enjoy today's seminar.
Thank you, Kristen. And for another quick introduction and to introduce our speakers today, I'd like to pass the mic over to Laura Chismo, who is a private sector advisor with the USAID Bureau for Food Security.
thank you, Julie, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today for this Ag Sector Council seminar focused on optimizing private sector engagement for smallholder impact within Feed the Future. Together with its partners, Feed the Future is delivering results that are reducing poverty and hunger in some of the world's poorest families. In this past year, Feed the Future has increased the value of agricultural products sold by farm households by $170 million. We've enabled the use of improved technologies and management practices on more than 4 million hectares and increased the value of new private sector investment within the agricultural sector by more than $160 million. USAID's Bureau for Food Security's Office of Market and Partnerships Innovation leads private sector engagement within Feed the Future and strives to increase the productivity and profitability of smallholder farmers through market-led innovation and dissemination of technology, private sector partnerships, and policy reforms that address farmer risk and finance. We view our private sector partners as thought leaders who can bring crucial feedback, a fresh perspective, and innovative insights to the development table. We are excited about today's events that highlight just a small portion of our portfolio that work towards these goals. Our first presenter will be Robert DeYoung, who is the Technology Commercialization and Models Lead for USAID's Feed the Future Partnering for Innovation Program implemented by FinTrack that promotes private sector engagement to commercialize technologies to smallholder farmers and enhance food security. He is the main author of our new guide, From Smallholders to Shareholders, which focuses on providing useful tools and insights into inclusive business models that maximize smallholder impact, and we'll be presenting on some main themes of that guide. He's also a specialist leader within the Moniteur Deloitte's commercial practice in the social impact service line. He has more than 20 years of experience and has held senior level positions in both for-profit and nonprofit organizations. We will then have the pleasure of hearing from one of our private sector partners, Louisa Parker of ADCO Corporation, about their strategy for reaching smallholder farmers. Louisa Parker is a manager of institutional funding and stakeholder relations for Africa and the Middle East at ADCO Corporation and is one of our core partners within a USAID partnership to bring small-scale silos storage to smallholder farmers in Zambia through Feed the Future Partnering for Innovation. Access to finance for smallholders is often a missing link in our best-intended programs and partnerships. Today, we will also hear from Tom Carroll, treasurer of the Global Development Incubator and the director of the Initiative for Smallholder Finance, a USAID-supported multi-donor effort designed to demonstrate how specific products and services can expand the reach of financing for smallholder farmers. He will discuss this challenge and new trends in finding solutions to unlock the much-needed financing for smallholders. Tom has extensive strategic advisory experience in a wide range of industries, and his most recent agricultural sector experience includes comprehensive market analysis, both global and sub-Saharan African horticultural markets, and the development of numerous private sector partnerships across a host of commodity markets. Thank you again for joining us today, and I will pass it over to Robert.
Thank you, Laura, and good morning to all of you, and good day to everybody who's online, and good evening as well for those who are in time zones very far away from us, and I'm delighted to be here. As Laura mentioned, I'm going to provide a few highlights of the recent publication we launched last week entitled From Smallholders to Shareholders, and then, of course, a lot of the deeper content will come from our two additional guests, Louisa and Tom, who will get into some of the nitty-gritty aspects of some of the things that I'll be speaking about more generally. So I thought I'd begin with a pop quiz. It's early morning, it's a rainy day. I thought some of you might like to kind of get your mind working a little bit. And I wanted to talk about a few misconceptions about working with smallholder farmers in emerging markets. So I'd like to see a show of hands in a true or false as I go through the following slides. Show of hands, true or false. Smallholder farmers prefer cheap products. True? Show of hands. False? Correct. Smallholder farmers are actually willing to pay more for a product that is risk-free. They even don't like free products because they think because they're free, there must be something wrong with them. And a lot of people assume that they just prefer the cheapest thing out there. That's not necessarily true. Second misconception. Successful models with smallholder farmers are high-volume, low-margin businesses. True? Show of hands. False? In this case, it depends, actually. Some of the models are high-volume, low-margin, but some of the other models are high volume, high margin. And of course, the trick part is what's in italics, successful. We have seen successful models in both, but increasingly there's evidence to demonstrate that high volume, high margin businesses are possible when working with smallholder farmers. Smallholder finance is best done through banks and not companies. True? Show of hands. False? So this one is an interesting question. It's another one where it depends. And I think Tom will talk a little bit about this towards the end of our session today. This is a contentious point, and there are various perspectives as to what works best and what will get us to scale more effectively and more efficiently as we move more actively into smallholder financial models. Local regulatory issues do not interfere with low-income business models. True? Do not interfere. False? False? Clearly they do. They do in many different ways. And the enabling environment or disabling environment can be a critical barrier to entry for many companies as they pursue these kinds of business models in emerging markets. Risk in low-income markets is very well understood, especially by private sector actors. Especially. True? False? Very good. Indeed, it is not well understood. And especially in new market entry strategies, they often entirely miscalculate what it's going to take to be successful and what the looming risks are, like what's beneath the iceberg when they enter those markets. And lastly, companies engage with smallholders primarily to improve their reputation. True? False? It's not too long ago where CSR is what drove a lot of smallholder engagement. But increasingly, I think the case for leveraging your core business and driving business growth through these kinds of models has been made. And so really it's about making money. It's in the core business interest to pursue these models in a number of different ways. So these misconceptions can often lead to failure. And here are a few of the failures that we've seen through some of the research we've done. Oftentimes, an inclusive business model with smallholder farmers can fail because the model is not mature enough. There may be some places where the model works, but maturity suggests that it should work in a variety of contexts, in a variety of geographies. In many cases, it has not yet been proven, and so the business model fails when it's attempted to be replicated. Second, which we already addressed a little bit, is definitely a lack of market understanding. What it takes to be successful with smallholder farmers is often not well known and often not implemented correctly. That was a thunderous noise. The third, there's obviously a lot of inadequate logistical infrastructure. These are real barriers to entry that can inhibit the growth of many of these business models. Without logistics and the appropriate infrastructure, a lot of these models can often fail. Lack of access to finance, and again, Tom will speak to this during his session. There's increasingly a lot of social lenders engaging in this space, but the big question mark is around, can commercial lenders move down market and move down market into rural areas? And how can they do that effectively? So there still is an enormous lack of access to finance. The smallholder segment is not well served. And lastly, there is an underestimation of the degree of customization required. Many of the products and services that work in middle-income or high-income markets just don't translate to low-income markets. Low-income consumers and smallholders don't make purchasing decisions in the same ways that other markets do. And so the degree of customization is often woefully misunderstood and miscalculated, leading to a lot of mistakes that many companies can make in those markets. So after that bleak picture, I'm not here to say that nothing works. I'm also not here to say that business models are the panacea. But certainly there is hope. There are things that are working, and I'll highlight a couple of those things. Obviously, this is not quite the Wheel of Fortune, but if all these things were happening, we'd probably not all be sitting here, but we'd be out drinking champagne and celebrating a lot more success. But obviously, if we have better affordability, we have improved access to inputs of technology, we have improved distribution, productivity, access to finance, and market access, obviously, smallholder farmers would benefit immensely, and the companies who engage with them as well. So given that, what works and why? And the guide that we just launched last week talks about 11 business models that have been shown through case studies and otherwise to be somewhat successful. Of course, it all depends on context and some of the issues that I mentioned as misconceptions and risks that occur in many environments. I'm not going to get into all the models, obviously, because there is no time, and it's hard to summarize 6 months of work into 15 minutes. But if you go to the guide, you'll see many of these represented in a very innovative way. So what we did as part of the guide was to try to provide a useful framework to think about and analyze business models. So we adapted the business model canvas to keep things simple and applied it to the smallholder context. And so we have a business model canvas that covers these six elements. Really, you know, what's the company value? How does a company create value? How does it make money in some of these models? How does it go to market? How does the product or service get from point A to point B in the most effective manner? How do they do it? How do they create smallholder value? So how does a smallholder win? And what do they gain from that engagement? What is the customer experience like? So what's happening between the company and the smallholder? Is it direct engagement? Is it indirect? Is it using outsourced solutions? Is it insourced? Is it using different ways of engagement to be successful? And how does it scale and become sustainable? All questions that are very relevant to the kinds of thinking that underpins successful private sector partnerships. And lastly, we also speak a little bit about the role of the donor, like a USAID. How can a donor play a de-risking role or a role in accelerating the value of many of these business models as they get implemented through partnerships? So I'll pick one example. And one example that we highlight is shared channel distribution. Sounds like a very technical word for something very simple. But the idea is that businesses who have a difficult time getting to market can leverage the assets of someone else, of another player, to get their product to market more effectively and look for ways, innovative ways, of bundling their services. So they piggyback on existing distribution systems. They try to use a frontline sales force. There is high interaction between the company and its products and the end consumer, in this case, the smallholders, and it can leverage many value chain competencies. When we apply, obviously, the shared value canvas, as we call it, we can talk about the fact that it really helps reduce the costs for the company. It can generate new revenue because it's a new way of delivering their product to market and growing a new market segment. It increases access and affordability for the smallholder, so it can be very successful and useful for them as well. And obviously, it can really enhance scale and sustainability because depending on the infrastructure and platform that they use, that might be something that has immense coverage in many rural areas. And so it can get to market more quickly, grow more rapidly, and it's a much more efficient way than doing it themselves. We also developed this sort of contextual assessment tool because, as I said earlier in my remarks, it always depends on the context. Context matters, and context will help shape and define the business model you use. And we try to come up with some of the key uncertainties that drive the choices you make when you think about the right business model you want to use in your different smallholder contexts. So in this case, we're looking at, for shared channel distribution, four elements. The notion of, you know, the complexity of distribution. If it's high, it's really how much control are you willing to give up to be able to have a better interaction with your end consumer? Because in this case, you're using someone else's distribution network, not your own. In the case of customization, how much do you have to change your product to be effective? The more you need to change it, the higher your cost structure. So how do you work that out? Do you localize that? Do you look for a third-party manufacturer? How do you think about that sort of customization that's required? What is the kind of behavioral change required? In shared channel distribution, as you'll see in the next slide where we'll talk about an example, you'll see that the behavioral change was very, very light because it took advantage of an existing behavioral pattern of the smallholder farmer. And you'll see what I mean by that in a second. And the last is affordability. What's the right price point for the product or service? And how will that determine if it will be a real seller or not? Will it be competitive or not? So there's an example in India where there's a joint venture between MCX, which is a commodities exchange, and the Indian Postal Service. And the wonderful thing about this example is that the Indian Postal Service has infrastructure everywhere. And they're able to reach many rural areas in ways that cannot be done normally. And MCX, being a commodities trading platform, wanted to be able to provide useful information to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of smallholders across India. So what were they able to do? Obviously, for the company, they were able to generate a whole new segment for sales and increase their profits, while for the smallholders, they opened up a whole new world of information, of inputs, and a lot of bundled services that could be used around the postal service system. And lastly, what was successful about it was that they could leverage the last mile infrastructure that the postal service offered. They could share these extensive networks, and they could play a role of aggregator. They could aggregate the demand that smallholders had for specific products. And in so doing, were able to reduce the costs of those inputs, for example, and other services for the smallholder community as a whole. So one example of one element of their business model, they wanted to sort of they create awareness about the offering that GSK provides. So they've simply put a blackboard on the front of a post office in a rural area to really get a sense of what's the input demand. They are given a 10% advance to be able to say, I want X volume of whatever inputs they are. They consolidate all of those demands, as I said earlier, under one model, under one transaction, with a number of different providers that they already work with, input providers. They provide, obviously, they ensure that there's much more efficient delivery of those solutions and products to the post office. They deliver it directly to the smallholder farmer. And on top of that, they also provide training. So it is a number of different models rolled into one. But fundamentally, it is about leveraging an existing channel and using that intelligently as a company. So some key themes about what works within this context. And yes, the fingers did actually touch. You're not. the first is that successful business models in this space should generally be high touch, meaning that there needs to be a lot of engagement between the smallholder and the company for it to be successful. And that means that things like extension and engagement and training are fundamental to success and to long-term success. The second is that you'll need to have a lot of innovative smallholder finance schemes. These could be everything from philanthropic capital to commercial transactions and commercial lending and everything in between. Tom will speak to some of these as well during his presentation, and Louisa will allude to them in hers. But obviously, it's a critical piece and often a missing piece in many of these business models. There obviously needs to be the aggregation of supply to have economies of scale. And if you're wondering what this is, these are not raisins. These are actually stingrays aggregating somewhere in the ocean in the South Pacific. I thought it was a really cool picture, so I thought I'd share it. But it really is about aggregating supply to be effective and reach those economies of scale. Most successful business models in this space require some degree of third-party facilitation. That could be a donor, it could be a nonprofit organization, another kind of institution that can play a role of ethical agent, that can create an environment of trust that can breed success. And in many cases, effective customer segmentation is not just smallholders as one big group. They're successful segments within them that have to be prioritized and thought of in different ways. So the idea, as I said earlier, of the contextual assessment tool is that it's dynamic. No matter what business model we talk about or you look at, context will drive how it evolves and changes based on the market. That seems obvious to many. But in many cases, they believe that replication is really simple. Once we get it right here, it's going to work over there. That's not always the case. This kind of tool can help ask the right questions to help you think how one should adapt and customize given your local context. So some of the key takeaways, and I'll be wrapping up now, given the short time that I have. The first is that for successful private sector partnerships, or the notion of introducing innovation and technology in the context of smallholder farmers, getting the business model right is fundamental. Trying to do technology introduction in smallholder contexts without an appropriate business model is like trying to fly a plane without wings. We know what will happen. It goes up, it might look great, and then go straight down, right? So it's really important to think about what's the right business model and really understand what works. The second, as I mentioned repeatedly, context matters. It's fundamental. Understanding your context will really drive how you shape your business model to make sure it engages successfully. Third, it's fundamental to understand and manage risk. A lot of the roles that different stakeholders play is trying to de-risk the business model so that the right players come to engage. Finance can be crowded in, the right private sector partners can engage, and so donors can and should think about their role as how to bridge the gap, create confidence and trust, and look for strategic ways of de-risking the investments that the private sector wants to make in these markets. Fifth, it's about establishing meaningful partnerships across sectors, not just public-private, but private-private, private-civil society, and different mechanisms that can really make these models come to life. And lastly, it's about knowing your customer. Understanding that smallholders behave and think differently than regular customers and ensuring that the models are tailored to their specific needs. So, to keep it simple, 6 A's, it's about understanding and creating awareness among the smallholder segment about the products and services, making sure those products and services can be made affordable, ensuring that they can be made available to those markets, ensuring that they're accessible to those markets. It's making sure that it's acceptable, meaning that it fits within their behavioral norms and they're able to use it effectively, and that it's adaptable, adapted specifically to their needs and modalities. And if you want to learn more about some of these themes, you can go to partneringforinnovation.org and you can download a copy of the guide. And I think we also have them on thumb drives just outside when you leave today. They'll be available for print in the next couple of weeks. I'm looking at my colleagues. Yes? So thank you for your time and for your patience.
Thank you, Robert. And I do want to encourage everyone, there will be thumb drives on the desk when you leave, so please pick up a copy. And for those online at the webinar, please go to partneringforinnovation.org and download your copy. I'm going to pass it off to our next speaker who's joining us virtually from London, Louisa Parker of ADCO. Okay, so we're trying to reestablish connection with Louisa, so we will jump forward and pass it off to Tom Carroll, and then try again at the end with Louisa.
All right. I'm going to stand up here, but if I start pacing like a cat, I will I will sit back down. I don't actually know Louisa's slides, so I'm not going to try and present this. I'll click through where hers are and get to what I think is a narrower focus than what she was going to present, and it's really kind of diving into the work that we're doing right now around smallholder finance. So I'll give you a little bit of background on what the Initiative for Smallholder Finance is and how it developed, how we're framing the market, and then kind of channel into one particular area of research to talk about and get a little bit closer to some of the successful models, and then caveat what we mean by success. The Initiative for Smallholder Finance is a platform for research and development of financial services for the smallholder farmer market, and it's both donor organizations and capital providers and practitioners And just a couple of nuts and bolts of who we are. We are a time-bound 3 to 5 year effort. And the idea was there is a, there is an opportunity for market intervention here, but there isn't a requirement for setting up a whole new institution for this. And there is a way for a number of partner organizations in the market to get together, and start coordinating some of their activities and sharing information and research in a different way. Three main things that we do. One, we research. Two, we facilitate actors in the market coming together. And three, we want to get into and have begun brokering really specific transactions that will help prove the model for how you move finance in this market and financial services. And obviously the goal of our market is to close that gap between what the market size we've identified is roughly $450 billion and the $10 to $20 billion in supply that's out there right now. I'm not making the claim that there's a $450 billion addressable market. The addressable market's probably, you know, 2 to 3 times what's out there now, but then there's a whole lot of demand generation and market development activity that would need to happen to get to that broader number. We got a ton of logos up there, so I'm going to go through a little bit of who's involved here. The Global Development Incubator, in the reading of my bio, I realized I forgot to put in the whole decade at Dahlberg. The Global Development Incubator is a spin-off from Dahlberg Global Development Advisors. And in fact, I was a partner there for the 8 years prior to this past September, before I made the leap over to the public charity we set up to house initiatives and on one side of the house and on the other side of the house deal with social enterprise acceleration. The Initiative for Smallholder Finance is actually one initiative of, I think, 6 that we have within the incubator right now. And it's the largest and most mature. We have a group of sponsors. USAID is obviously one of them. These are our steering committee participants, Citi Foundation, Skoll Foundation, Ford, KFW, and MasterCard. Gates Foundation has actually recently joined us as well. And we have an advisory committee. Sort of an official advisory committee, and that's Root Capital, TechnoServe, CGAP, Business Fights Poverty, and Andy, the Aspen Network for Development Entrepreneurs. We actually have a whole host of advisors, but those are the ones that show up at meetings currently. A little bit of history. In September 2012, we launched a report, and this was back when I was a partner at Dahlberg, called Catalyzing Smallholder Agricultural Finance. And this was sort of the what spawned the initiative. And interesting, it comes from a couple of different places. The Citi Foundation came to us, Graham McMillan, because they had been getting requests from managing directors on the commercial side of the house who were managing multinational relationships in the food industry. And those multinational companies were coming to them and saying, we've got smallholders in our supply chains. We don't really know what to do with them. There's a financial need here. Can you help us? And the MDs were saying, we have no idea what this market's all about. And so they tossed it over to the foundation side and said, can you put a frame on this market? How big is it? What's happening in it? Who's playing? And how's it going to grow? Similarly, the Skoll Foundation was looking to top off its investment in Root Capital, which is one of the social lenders, which we'll talk to in a second. But Skoll's board had similar questions, which is, we love Root, but what's their market about? Where's it going to be in 10 years? What are they growing into? And how do we see this model actually becoming scalable or sustainable? So hence the initiative was born. In that report, we laid out these 5 growth pathways. And I'll take you through those very quickly and then talk about how that relates to how we're set up and the work we do. The report itself, one thing we did, we kind of came out with a big number, and that's the $450 billion. So we said, we did some consulting math and came up with how big is this thing going to be within the realm of reasonable. So it was a swag, but it was a calibrated swag. And the second thing was talking through all of the constraints, kind of lining up who are the actors in the space who are set against these constraints in an interesting way, and what's going to happen next. And then sort of next, looking forward, what are the areas for growth where we can really see some penetration for financial services to the smallholder market. And you'll notice these are not actually mutually exclusive or comprehensive, but these were the ones that we thought are most interesting, and it's a blend of business models, products, and actual customer segments. So the first one was replicate and scale the existing social lending model. And who here is familiar with the term social lending? Okay. So just a quick definition. Social lenders are the largest of them have formed a group called the Council on Smallholder Agricultural Finance. And this is Root, Capital, Oikra Credit, Triodos, Shared Interest, Responsibility, AlterFin, and Rabobank. And they're the ones that have traditionally provided trade capital to cooperatives. And that's been their target market with a heavy concentration in export cash crops, in particular coffee in Latin America. But they have worked out a business model that has been successful in the past. They've been growing their penetration in that market. And the idea was where, from a commodity perspective and from a geography perspective, do they need to replicate and grow? The second area was let's look at the product portfolio, and there's obviously a big need for long-term lending to the smallholder. And by long-term, we had to come up with a definition, so we said anything longer than 12 months. And what we were really talking about here were renovation loans and some sort of asset finance. The third was, and this is called financing the outgrower screens of multinational buyers, but this begins to get to that question that Robert was talking about earlier, which is, do you want to be using third parties to provide finance, or do you want them to actually be going directly through and working with the multinationals who have their own trade finance portfolios? And there is an if-when question, whether the multinational is the one that's best positioned to provide that finance, or actually if they've capped their growth related to what they want to do from a banking or financial service perspective, and they need a third party to come in. How do you know? When do you know? The fourth area was around alternate aggregation points. When we first set this out, we thought we'd be looking more at warehouse receiving. And obviously a ton of work's being done on that. So we think we're going away from that a little bit rather than reinventing the wheel. And looking more at what are the input providers doing. And the networks that they have set up. Are there opportunities to do point of sale and transactional work within the input providers' networks? And the last piece was on finance direct to farmers. And so we want to make a clear distinction here. What we're talking about is the third-party finance providers who are trying to do direct lending to farmers. So it's some adaptation of microfinance models is kind of a good way to visualize it, but there's a whole host of different business models that are trying to get after this right now. As distinct from what the input providers might be doing, which also might be direct, or what the multinationals might be doing, which also might be direct. This is the third-party piece of it. So we, over the summer, now continuing into the fall, we had a research and design process. And so we created the database of roughly 160 organizations in consultation with CGAP, organizations who are actually financial service providers of these types of services. And one thing I should say, we had a really heavy credit bias when we started out on this. As soon as we got to this area of the world, credit bias fell. It's credit, savings, insurance. And now when we start to do some of the ideation around new products and services, we're talking more about blended financial services. What is the real need and use within the farmer household? And how does that cross or combine what has traditionally been credit, savings, and insurance products? So we had a large research effort to try and figure out what's happening here. And then we had a design effort where we got a whole host of practitioners in the market. And this was anywhere from the financial service providers themselves to data firms to MNOs to some funders, and we led a two-day human-centered design workshop. And the idea here was similar to this questionable idea of success. Inherently, in a lot of these models, they are not built to scale and they're not currently commercially sustainable. So how do we tease apart what's happening in the marketplace right now in terms of Here are the key challenges that we're getting after. What are the key areas of experimentation that's actually in the market, so a bit of knowledge sharing? And then lastly, if we take some of those experimental models, what's the next generation look like? Along these key dimensions of areas where you can affect the business model in a way that it might be sustainable and scalable. So very quickly, I don't know if any of you have been through the human-centered design process before, but depends on how it's structured, but you throw a ton of ideas up on the wall. A room like this would be plastered with hundreds of ideas. And we went through that. So this is kind of a collapsing of that. And we came up with five areas where a lot of the ideas seem to cluster. One is in field efficiency, and this is talking about field and branch-based delivery as key drivers of operational costs. What's happening to try and lower those operational costs? The second was around agronomic learning, kind of a funny point that relates to Robert's kind of more comprehensive look at what's happening with the smallholder market. You know, this was a financial service human-centered design two-day workshop. So we got all these ideas up on the wall, and I kind of leaned to one of my partners and said, nothing about finance up here. All of the challenges that they had identified were kind of around the financial service and product. Said, how do we solve these problems that are inhibiting, you know, what are pretty commodified or standard ways of doing and interacting financial services? So agronomic learning is obviously a key one of those codependencies that can also help enhance productivity. Obviously, that does wonders for your repayment and risk profile. Credit assessment, how do you score smallholders? How do you have enough information to score and understand what the real risk is going to be? Fourthly, portfolio diversification. A lot of discussion, particularly around different crops, of the lumpiness of the cash flows within the farmer household. How do you design around that, both from a product and service portfolio, but then how does the financial institution think about their portfolio and managing risks within that lumpiness? And lastly, individual motivation. A lot of this is done through group work and group incentives. So within those group structures of lending, how do you incentivize individuals? And what kind of adaptations can you make to the model to make them more sustainable? And what I'll do is just quickly take you through a couple of the experiments that are out there, and they're pilots. They haven't been taken to scale yet, but then move that to, all right, what does the ideation process then kind of get us thinking about going forward? The first was in infield efficiency. Obviously, there's a big digital component to this, and there's a whole lot that's happening in terms of both mobile information and mobile payments. And so, you know, very tangible examples of this. One-acre fund, they're using loan repayment using mobile money. So what does that do? You know, from a supply-side perspective, big part of the cost driver, you need these high-touch businesses. How do you have the high touches without the costs that are associated with them? And how do you better your field ratios, which is the number of field officers that you have that are touching the number of farmers? And that's what actually can make the whole model get closer to operational break-even. Pushing that one level further, Opportunity International currently has mobile van branches where they're actually bringing the financial services outside of the large towns and bringing them to communities and rural environments. This has been really successful. In fact, so successful that they've developed an offshoot of this where they're using containers and they're dropping a bank in some of the communities. So these are obviously already getting to some of the issues. But how do you take that one level further? So there's a whole lot of applications that are built right now or being built for larger cooperative structures. How do you drop that one level lower to the farmer, the farm group leader, so that you can offload some of those administrative tasks and make the communication with the individual farmers a whole lot smoother? And again, we've got a slew of these next generation ideas. Just in the interest of time and some Q&A, I'll hold it at that level. Next area, when we talk about agronomic learning, technology-assisted training for farmers, this is clearly happening. In one of the asset-based financing models, Jehudi Kalima, that Robert mentioned, they're getting into video training by tablet. So they're arming their field officers with tablets that can go in and actually use non-text-based examples of how you do some of this better agronomic practices. And similarly, SafariCom and iCow, they've got agricultural tips by SMS. And they're doing this in a number of different markets, and they're able to customize it. And as you can see, it says 3 Kenyan shillings per SMS. So there is actually a revenue stream coming out of this as well for them. Not break even yet, but getting there. And again, this is one of the low margin scale businesses. How do you take that further? So if you think about the Jehudi tablet, what if Jehudi actually had, the Jehudi field officer had access not just to that video, but a whole repository of content and could customize the experience with the farmer. So you don't actually homogenize your farmers because we know they all have unique learning needs. You can come up and say, okay, it's actually financial literacy that we need to talk about today rather than your agronomic practices. Here's the module that I can pull up and give you for that. We have a ton of different NGOs and learning partners in the space. How about we collapse some of that learning into a place where the field officers can access it? Again, interest of time, I got the high sign. There's a whole lot happening in this space. So I think the key takeaways here are this is a key part of the problem. It's clearly not the only part of reaching smallholders. There's a whole lot of success in terms of how do you reach and impact smallholders when it comes to financial services. I think there's a whole lot that needs to be done if you talk about success defined not as reach and impact, but success defined as sustainably commercial organizations that are rapidly increasing that penetration rate of the smallholder farming community. I think the third point would be there's a ton of innovation here. And so this market where it is today, even when we got started 2 years ago, it's an entirely different place. So with that.
Thank you, Tom. And let me just check. Do we have Louisa Parker online? Yes. So please let me pass it back over to Louisa Parker of ADCO Corporation. Julie's going to quickly dial back the PowerPoint to your first slide, Louisa.
Okay, thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, dependent on when you're joining us from today. My name's Louisa Parker. I work for ADCO. I'm the Manager for Institutional Funding and Stakeholder Relations for Africa and Middle East region. It's great to be joining you all today. I was really asked to talk to you about three areas, really, on behalf of ADCO. Firstly, to give you a very quick overview of ADCO's strategy in Africa. Secondly, to talk a little bit about some of the specific projects that we're working on, the Future Farm concept, and particularly Bags to Bulk, which is supported by USAID and the Feed the Future Partnering for Innovation. And then lastly, I guess, to provide an overview of the challenges that we're facing as private sector in the market in relation to introducing sustainable mechanisation. So very briefly, with regards to ADCO, for those of you that aren't familiar with the organisation, we design, manufacture and distribute agricultural machinery through our five core brands that you can see on the slide just there. Challenger Fence, GSI is our grain storage brand, Massey Ferguson, our global brand, probably the best known, and many of you I'm sure will have heard of Massey Ferguson, and Valtra. Vision is high-tech solutions to professional farmers feeding the world, and I should say that this is as much relevant for Africa as for many other parts of our business. Africa is one of the regions where we've seen the most growth actually in recent years. So ADCO, we're the largest pure play agricultural manufacturing company worldwide. By pure play, we're not in the construction industry, we don't get involved in anything to do with agro processing, but we do provide a full line of agricultural equipment. Tractors are probably best known for, combines, sprayers, implements, grain storage equipment and hay and forage tools. and we interact primarily in the market through a network of independent distributors and dealers, and we have around about 3,100 dealers worldwide, and many of the, pretty much every country in Africa, I think, is covered, all bar one or two. So AGCO's strategy for Africa, it's very much about providing solutions to African farmers. Our strategy, our current strategy, was developed around about 3 years ago and is founded on the four pillars that you see there, products, future farms, local footprint, and finance. So I go more into detail on product and future farms in the coming slides, but on local footprint, just to say, we've invested quite heavily in this as a manufacturer actually having a presence on the continent. We have an office in Cape Town, a dedicated parts warehouse in Johannesburg, our future farm in Zambia, and we've entered recently a joint venture with the Algerian government for the assembly of Massey Ferguson tractors in Algeria, specifically for the Algerian market, but in the longer term with a view to exporting to the rest of Africa. On finance, we have a partnership with Standard Bank in South Africa. We have other partners at country and project level, but I guess for our strategy, this is still one of our greatest challenges, and an area where we still have some way to go. So in September last year, Dr. Rob Smith joined AGCO as our new Senior Vice President for the region, for EAME region, with a very specific remit to develop AGCO's markets, particularly in Russia and particularly in Africa. So under Rob's direction, we are now in the process of refining our Africa strategy and for the first time having a specific strategy for emerging farmers, which I think is really positive. And it's no surprise to any of you on the chat today or in the room there that the majority of our farmers in Africa are smallholders. And I noticed earlier some of the chats, people were saying, okay, well, what's the definition of smallholders? It's not a one-size-fits-all. And absolutely, I agree with that. And certainly for private sector, this is one of the challenges that we have when looking at this market in particular. So you'll see that how we do this at AGCO, we break down the Africa farmers into four segments. Smallholders broadly into subsistence and emerging, and then we have mid-sized domestic agribusiness and large-scale commercial farmers. And the numbers across the bottom are the segmentation based on the numbers that we've pulled from the Zambia market. And again, it shows how you can sort of break these down at country level. I think the challenge for AGCO and for our distribution, particularly when introducing mechanization, is to look at who are the fastest adopters of technology, but in a way that maximizes the opportunity to trickle down to the smallholder or to the subsistence farmer. And so an example of this would be targeting lead farmers or even local entrepreneurs at community level to then act as contractors and provide services to those around them. And often it's those lead farmers and those people within the community that have the local networks and understand how best to get these services to the smaller farmers that perhaps can't afford to buy machinery themselves. And there are many models. It could equally be identifying bankable or viable farmers' organisations and supporting them with access to mechanisation. So how are we doing this? Well, I guess first and foremost, our strategy has to start with product. So having a product that's suitable to the market, that's competitive in terms of its ability and its quality and of course on price. We now have a dedicated team looking at mechanisation packages. And we're talking about packages here that address all parts of the value chain where AGCO product touches the farmer's operation. And actually, this seems like quite a simple thing, particularly from a machinery company, but it's actually quite a step change within the business. Our starting point now is very much that the customer wants to put a seed in the ground and end up with a...
We'll wait a couple minutes while we're waiting. I'll just give what I was going to say at the very end.